Our podcast guest this week is Mary Coughlan, former Fianna Fáil politician and current chairperson of the Donegal GEA County Board. Mary, thank you so much for accepting our invite and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
A very, very busy person. You don't like the quiet life, obviously, because you go from the pot into the fire and you're always flat out, it seems.
Yeah, most people give out that I should have learned to slow down, but it's not in my nature. So I still keep myself very busy. And anybody that I know who's changed careers or have retired are equally the same. So I think it's everybody's a contribution to make in life. And just because you're a particular age doesn't mean that you're not important. And this is just the kind of me that I'm always busy and like to be.
Yeah. And you were born into a busy household. Would you describe yourself as being born into politics?
Not necessarily. My father was a school teacher. My mother, previously a hotelier, and then a psychiatric social worker, and then gave it all up to rear all of us. So we had a busy life because Daddy also had a farm. So, you know, that was the lifestyle we had. Politics was there. Current affairs was very important in our house. But I suppose my mother kind of shielded us from political life. Clement was a county councillor for many, many years who was lived next door. But I suppose she tried to shield us all. My father would have been involved in politics. He would have been secretary of the Cumann, involved in the Corley Cantor and the Dáil Cantor probably. But although it would have been more history and current affairs as opposed to politics at the time.
But obviously, you know, the state of the country, the state of the area, all of that kind of stuff always discussed around the kitchen table, and you'd be acutely aware of everything going on.
Absolutely. And I suppose we all reflect on our young days as being idyllic. I suppose they were in many ways, but one of the reasons they were is that everybody was the same. There was no differentiation. We all went to school. People had hand-me-downs. There was seven in our house, seven in Clemens. There was eight in Austin. So, you know, big families. Brady's lived up the road. So, you know, everybody lived in each other's.
Big families can have their advantages and their disadvantages too. If you can keep everyone on the same page in the family of seven, I think you're doing well.
You are doing well. Round the table. Well, I suppose we had we had lots of friends. We had a lot of freedom when we were very young. We lived beside the beach. You know, we always thought the weather was good. It probably wasn't, but that was the boys played football, you cycled. You know, you had that freedom. I suppose that freedom was also the fact that it was safe. There wasn't as much traffic on the road.
Yeah,
there weren't these big
issues
that we have now where people have to be overly cautious about looking after their kids.
Do you think because I had the exact same childhood as you had in Leahy, complete and utter freedom with barriers, but
you did what you were told.
Yeah, exactly. and I often wonder with raising, you know, my three boys, is my helicopter parenting or fear or all the advice I instill into them, is it justified? Like, is the world a much less safer place than when you and I were growing up and had that completely free life?
It's less safe. I suppose we got up in the morning and you went out the door and Mommy used to ring a bell for the dinner.
The white sheet went out over the balcony in our house.
But we also had to work.
Yeah.
So, you know, you worked in the house, you helped out at home at the housework, and you also worked in the farm. So we had that work ethic as well. Look, there's far more traffic on the road. You had to be careful crossing the road. Like, that's standard practice. We live beside the sea. You respected the water. There's certain parameters that are there that are basic, that are still very important now and again. You didn't talk to strangers. You were always told that. The other thing that has changed, I think, is if you went out for a night, you never came home and left somebody behind.
No, that's so true, yeah.
You never did that. Now that seems to happen a bit. And I suppose people stuck out together because you're going to be in trouble anyway for being late. So it's all for one and one for all, where things are different now. So I don't, you know, maybe we are overprotective in other ways, and I can see that. where we now talk about the need for resilience in our young people, their capacity to make better decisions. You know, all of those things are out there that maybe we've mollycoddled people too much.
Because speaking to people in business, what they do see from graduates is, you know, often a lack of resilience. Say, for instance, in one of the growing sectors in this country, renewable energy and all that type of stuff. I mean, like, I've spoken to leaders in that industry who are going and trying to retrain 40 and 50 year old electricians because they're struggling to get the work output from younger people. Now, there's all different types of younger people, don't get me wrong.
No,
but you do wonder, or I do wonder sometimes, if it's all interconnected to some extent, and that while we think we're doing the right thing, perhaps it's
probably, and life's not perfect, and there's going to be ups and downs, and people are going to have tragedies in their life, and they're going to, you know, things don't always work out, and not necessarily hardship. There was hardship previously, and that was real hardship. People might not have enough money, they had nothing to eat, they didn't have access to education. Like, there has been massive changes and people have been given massive choices, but I think until you have an opportunity to be older, you have to realize that there are things there that you're going to be hurt about, and you have to be able to deal with those things and move on.
For sure. Your father's entry into politics. Talk to me about that. What age did that come for you? Because that's a big change.
It was a big change. I was in, now I'd gone on and I had been in my leaving cert. I'd been in my leaving certificate. Well, first of all, Clement was killed in an accident, which was just awful. Absolutely awful. He was 40 years of age. Peggy was left with 7 small children, some of them teenagers, and the youngest was very young. In those days, the support for TDs was very little, only for the INTO, to be fair. They would have struggled even more. So that was a desperate tragedy that Clement was killed. There was political nuances as well, but from a family point of view, it was awful.
And you have to, suppose, balance the two.
You have to balance the two. And then that was a time of political upheaval. It's been well documented about the heave against Charlie. There was a Senate election, et cetera, et cetera. Then there was a lot of pressure put on my father to go forward for election. A lot of it came from our local commons. And he was hesitant because he loved teaching and he liked farming. And he liked to be in Donegal. And it was a huge change to have to move to Dublin. But he relented. So I would say he was a reluctant politician in the beginning.
What do you think tipped him over the edge in accepting it? Was it a legacy thing? You know,
bit of that. Or, and the fact that Clement had only had 3 years.
Yeah.
And Clement had 3 elections in 3 years. And I suppose he got a lot of support from the locality, from our local people that wanted him to go. And he went into the county council and went into the Dáil, and he was only starting to enjoy what he was doing when unfortunately he got sick. So he found that a huge change. And I suppose he didn't believe in his own capacity, where in fact he was more than able to do the job. And he, you know, was very driven that he was there to support the people that elected him, and that was his calling. And you know, in our house, and I was in boarding school, but you know, you get up in the morning and everybody's getting ready for school, and there'd be 10 or 11 standing at the kitchen table because daddy would be going to the council. Those days people didn't travel as much, so we'd be helping them with their tax or with an SI house or what, planning or whatever it was. So it was a different era. So we were accustomed to people just walking in and out our house. So we're very familiar with that. But it was a big difference.
Yeah, and I think it's important that you point out the slight difference there is now. I know your phone's never off as a councillor now, and I know there's great pressure on TDs, but it was far more sort of integrated into the community back then, wasn't it? And that was an expectation as
well. And people drove to the office
to
see Kathleen or whoever, Marie or whoever it was, Bridge, in the office. People went to the office. And then the TDs went out and did clinics so that you could meet your TD in different places. You did it it used to be in the paper. Like, it used to be in the front page of the paper.
Funny, I was speaking to Dinny McGinley not so long ago on this podcast, and he talked of that as well, how different it was.
It was totally different. And plus the fact that people waited for an answer.
Yeah.
You wrote a letter or you made a phone call. And the pace of life was different. Very different. And there was great camaraderie between, say, the people who worked in the county council and their elected representatives, and everybody's trying to do their best. So you went to a county council meeting on Monday, you went round all the offices, you met all the staff, you took the messages, you took back the answers. You know, that was the way it was done. Now people send an email and they expect an instant response.
Mm. But also too, and this is not a criticism because I'm probably as guilty of it, we believe we have so much knowledge that it's very rare we'd be satisfied with a response.
Well, unless it's going your way.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So
unless it's going your way. But like, there's great friendships and things like that as well. But definitely when you look at the way politics has changed, it has been immeasurable.
Before we talk about your dad's sudden and sad passing and your enter into politics, you know, I mean, like, you come across as a very tough person, I think, to people. No, I'm not tough in a bad way. I'm on about resilient and, you know, and we'll get through to the first that you've achieved as a politician. But as a, especially in a family of seven, right, where was your place?
Oh, I was the boss.
You were the boss, right? Okay, so it's all starting to fall into place.
I was the oldest and I went to boarding school.
Yeah.
John was next. He went to boarding school in Falcarra for a while. The reason we went to boarding school was that some of the leaving certificate subjects weren't available in the Abbey Vocational School
right.
at the time.
That was the local school, obviously, to you, yeah.
And then it grew and developed massively. I think you went there yourself.
Yeah.
So then the rest, everybody else went to the Abbey Vocational
and
School.
And so in terms of so would you have been in consultation with your parents going, this is perhaps what I want to do or where I want to educate myself, and then you've decided as a or were your parents the type that would say, you know, if you want to achieve the best you can achieve, these are the types of courses, and then you can decide what you want
to do. No, education in our house was absolutely paramount.
Yeah.
We sat around the kitchen table. We still have that kitchen table, right. by the way. It was a memory we kept when Mommy died. And regardless of your age, you sat around that kitchen table.
Yeah.
Daddy would be doing the correcting. And you would have a wee mark in your own book to see when it was coming to your turn. So you were either going to kind of excuse yourself for 5 minutes in case you something would happen. But my father was the master. He was always the master. Mm. He never differentiated with any of us at school. And even if you weren't at school, you sat at the table and you did your drawing or your spelling or your reading or whatever. So education was hugely, hugely important in our house. So the view was that to the best of your ability, you made your choices.
Did we get to see your granddad with grandchildren or did he not live for that? It would have been interesting to see if the master's hat slipped, because you see that so often now, don't
Clement
you?
Was a master as well.
Right.
Auntie Tina was a school teacher. My Aunt Mary was a school teacher. And I think Paul Coughlin's the only one who became a school teacher. So it didn't move into the next generation.
Yeah, but I've seen, you know, when I see it in other families, but my mum and dad, like, and you see them with the grandchildren, or you did before they passed, and you'd be like, well, where were these people when I was that age?
I know,
there's
I
just
know.
Something, I think it's with maturity and all that type of stuff. Losing your dad at such a young age, I mean, as an adult now, you can reflect on perhaps what could have been in terms of his career and what he could have achieved and the influences he could have made. But at that time, it's a personal loss. And he sounds like he was very much held in high regard. Mm-hmm. You'd already had a recent tragic loss. And here we go again. Mm-hmm. It must have been incredibly tough.
It was very tough, and I would say it was probably tougher on the younger ones in our house, because there were still younger kids, and I was doing my finals at the time, so I was in university, John was in university, so we were that much older and we had much more time with my father, whereas the younger ones didn't. And that's difficult for any family. It's the same in any household where you when you lose someone. And Daddy died within 6 weeks. So it was a very short
illness.
He had cancer, he had a kind of a spot on his lip and thought it was an old coal sore, you know yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And he came here to Letterkenny and unfortunately he had to go to Dublin and he never came back.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So there was all of that as well, which, you know, medicine wasn't as progressive as it is now. There wasn't time. So that was very difficult on everybody in our house. Like Kevin was doing his leaving certificate.
Yeah.
And he went in the morning of Daddy's funeral to sit his exam. So, you know, and lots of people go through that. So you have to, you know, when these things happen, you know, it does have an impact on people. And you talked about resilience. I suppose one of the things that a cousin of mine, Adele, always used to say, we were so accustomed to death.
Yeah.
And tragedy over the years. Like Adele had lost brothers and sisters when they were very small. Clement was killed. My father had died. You know, there was a lot of that, and a lot of families unfortunately have to deal with that as well. So I suppose there was a bit of that resilience built up in us, unfortunately.
Yeah, toughness comes with it, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
But, and as you say, that the reason it's probably more difficult for the younger ones is they haven't had that weathering of very sad realities of life.
We better get a bit more positive.
I know,
here.
But do you know what? It's real life too.
Yeah.
I was going to stop. Well, we're going to go for you into politics. Is this positive?
It is positive.
Right. So, again, you know, this is a catalyst. You had you an interest in getting into politics? Because obviously, once your the dual mandate was there too.
Oh, it was. Well, I would have been in Ogra, Fianna Fáil, and in university, I was in the Kevin Barry Cumann, which was a huge Cumann. I was secretary there, and I was in college with Mary O'Rourke's son and Pádraig Flynn's daughter. And, you know, there were a lot of political people.
So you were
people.
Soaking stuff up there whichever way you turned, right?
So, and I also studied politics at UCD. So I had an interest in politics and political life. But my idea was I was going to go on and be a social worker. Mm. So I finished my exams. In those days, you did your exams at the end of August. And the same pressure was put on me to go forward. And my mother really didn't want me to go into political life because she saw the reality of it. But I said, look, it's still the same in politics. Sometimes that chance comes your way. And if you don't take that opportunity,
were you 20
it moves
or 21
on.
At that time?
I was 21. You had to be 21.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
You had to be 21 in order to be eligible.
Yeah. And the first port of call is the council then.
Yeah. So I went to the council in October. 1986.
And what was that like walking in there?
That was very different. Now, that's one way of cutting your teeth politically. You often hear the Cope talking about the local authority, but he's absolutely right. But I went into, I sat in my father's seat, which was Clement's seat, so it was beside McGlinchey, who would have had a reputation in this town. So I had some very heavy hitters to cut my teeth. So you had McGlinchey, McGowan, McGinley, you know, McEniff.
Yeah.
They were heavy hitters politically. Mm. And I entered into that fray.
Did you ever go, okay, maybe this is not quite what I thought it was going to be, or?
No, I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed it and I had, I enjoyed the local authority. I loved the county council. And then a lot of the TDs were on the local authority, as you know. And then I also got the opportunity to be on what's now the ETB, the VEC as it was known there, and I really, enjoyed that.
Mm.
So those were interests that I had. I liked education as well. But the local authority was hugely, hugely important to cutting your teeth politically.
Yeah.
And that's why I always say when I'm trying to encourage women into politics, start at your local level. That's where you get the opportunity to develop and to get to know the system. And of course, there were very few women in the local authority as well. I think Maureen was the only one at the time. And there were one or two others, but there weren't that many women elected to the county council.
Do we need to do anything to... You see, a lot of the problem is... A lot of the problem is there's a lot of people in the council for a long time. Mm. You know, there's a lot of people there. And you can't, they're elected, they're democratically elected. You can't say, look, you pack it in now and give someone else a shot, right? But it does mean, and then obviously parties have options sometimes with co-option, and even those that claim to be the most progressive go with a safer bet sometimes, right? Without getting into the into party politics of it all, but it makes change really difficult because it's really slow.
It is. No, being Fianna Fáil, I wouldn't agree with you.
Of course. Well, I am not going to get into that stuff, but anyway, go on.
I suppose there are people who are there for years and years and years, and it was the same in the Dáil, but I think that's changed. I do think that has changed. And, you know, you for example, you have independence. Now, unless you're fairly good and a good constituency worker, and if you don't do it, you know, whatever you were elected on may move on and you may not necessarily get re-elected as a consequence of being there for one reason only. So, look, I think things have changed. People are not lifers anymore in politics. There might be one or two, but in the main, that's not the case.
And even nationally, it's quite interesting to see people choosing to say, right, I've done my bit, now I'm going to step away. And it's not all, the cynic might go, oh yeah, because that's for, it's a cozy job. But some of them are actually just stepping away because they feel they've done their time.
They've done their time and they have enough done.
It's not necessarily because they've got some golden deal with the...
No. And the other thing is that it is a full-time, 24/7 job. And it's not just you that's involved, your family is involved as well, whether you like it or not. And if you have children and young children or, you know, a different type of family life that you came from, it is a big change. It is a huge change.
Another big change was stepping up to the Dáil. And I believe in that Dáil, was it the 25th, 26th? You were the youngest elected rep. Into the Dáil. So that's a remarkable achievement in and of itself.
Still am, apparently. Well, not by much, a couple of weeks, apparently.
You can get young wolves too, you know.
Luckily, I had been in the Dáil.
What was the campaign like? And
the campaign, oh my goodness, it was so cold. It was February. I remember canvassing in Ballyshannon and people were going to mass and I had to go and cut the jeans off. They were just the hailstones and the snow and the cold. We nearly died. It was a horrible, the weather was terrible. That didn't help. And it was a tough campaign, but I was new and it was different. So I was relying on people who were good, hardened canvassers and knew how to run a campaign.
And was there good camaraderie between, you know, the stalwarts and your Bundorans and your different parts of the county? Because, you know, you needed that really.
You weren't going to get elected without all those people.
Yeah.
And that was southwest Donegal. So it didn't have Letterkenny and places like that in it. So Ballyshannon Bundoran was where the population was. That's where you had a big concentration. You also had people elected in Ballyshannon and you also had people elected in Letterkenny. So you had that added support with your local elected people. So that did help. So you had South Donegal for Coughlin, you had the West for the Cope, and then we shared the Finn Valley. Yeah. And they were hugely political.
Tried and tested too.
And knew what to do. Yeah. So I just remember the cold. Oh my goodness, the cold. It was awful. And we only got 2 years because we're back again in 1989. Yeah. You know,
and back again and back again and back again for well over two decades. You were successful in that regard. So you talked about the walking into the council chamber. Now we're talking about going into the Dáil, and any sort of people, even with, you know, a political parents or what have you, there still is a shock when you go in and it takes a long time to find your feet. It's a big old place.
It is. I was very lucky that in my 3 years in university, I went into the office to my father nearly every Wednesday.
Ah, well, that's a good start.
So that was a good start. So did every other political family. You got your dinner and then you go up to the office and make a few phone calls for people or, you know, take messages or whatever. So I knew where to go, but, you know, going into the chamber, you're on your own. But I was very much supported by people who were elected, including Pat and Denny, to be fair, who were here and elected from many more years than myself. But it is a very lonely place. Mm. Regardless, you had to find your feet. I went into a parliamentary party, which was huge. Charlie Haughey was the Taoiseach. There wasn't much money about. There was actually no money about. Ray McSharry, whom I knew, his sons were in college with me, you know, so I knew quite a number of people. But I would say they found it more difficult the other way around, that I was the same age as their kids.
Yeah.
And here was me sitting beside them, yeah. You know.
Did you find it intimidating?
Again, not particularly.
It's not a word that I kind of associate. No. I don't know you terribly well, but it's not a word I'd associated with you, but it's just curious to ask as a 21-year-old going in.
I didn't find it intimidating. No, I didn't. I wouldn't have said it was intimidating.
Yeah. So, like, being the youngest in the Dáil, well, I'll come back to that in a second, because I wanted to ask you another question about how this daisy chained around. So obviously you had the loss of your uncle, then the loss of your dad, and then you go into and quite literally sat in your dad's seat in the council, and then you're elected to the Dáil. Off the public vote, not co-opted, so you did that yourself. But at that time, is there a point whereby you're sort of continuing your dad's work or the name, and then really, this is about Deputy Mary Coughlan here, and I want to step away from that now because this is a new era.
I had that for a while, and that was the reality. It was the Coughlan name.
Yeah.
But 1989, I remember being in Glenties at the convention, and that was the point I made, which was, yes, 1987, I got elected with a lot of help, but also the fact that my father had died and Clement had died and the Coughlan name, et cetera, et cetera. But I wanted to be my own person in 1989. So I just made that point. Now, of course, it helped. There's no two ways about it. The machine was there. But in 1989, I said, look, I have to be elected as Mary Coughlan.
Yeah. Because fundamentally, you are an individual. You live and die by what you do. You know, you stand before the people. You stand in the door. You know, there comes a point where it's, you know, that this is stepping forward.
Yeah.
But you didn't feel in any way that you were betraying a legacy or anything like that. There, it was just something that had to be done.
My mother's instilled independence in all of us.
Let me ask you about your mother. She was reluctant about you going to the council.
She was, yeah. But she always taught us.
To Dublin? Or had you broken her spirit at that point?
Oh, no. My mother was a very independent woman. You would have known her. She was Dawn Breslin's sister.
So of course.
She ran a fairly strong political machine herself.
Yeah.
And she was very much in the background. And that happens in all political families.
Mm.
Your wife or your husband or somebody belong to you is always that person that's there to when you're not there.
Mm.
So look at the decision was made, you moved on, and that was that. So she supported me all the way.
And in those early years, who was your rock? Who was your confidant, if you know what I mean, in terms of...
Well, if Noel McGinley's listening to this podcast...
Right.
There were the two Campbells,
and
Jim and Cahill. And they were Clement's stalwarts, and they were my father's, and they were mine for many, many, many years. And up here, there was the two Dannys. Danny Langan and Danny Lafferty were in Chrysler.
Yeah.
The two, you know, they were known as henchmen. That had a word, I don't know. They were the people that were there.
The unsung
they were
heroes.
On the ground. Mm. They knew people. They understood what people were thinking. They were well read. They had time to watch all the political programs. They had time to read all the papers. So they were the people that were your advisors, you know, in all fairness, they were the advisors.
Yeah, and you need that.
You do. Everybody in life needs somebody to talk to.
When you're based in Dublin for a long time, you know, I think it's human. It'd be very easy to lose that little bit of connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it can happen.
Because I know even from moving from South Donegal to North Donegal in a couple of years, you just that intimate knowledge or that sense of
people.
It's hard to know. Yeah.
And you always needed that, but you always had that. That's the thing about being a TD, a Chacta Dála. There's an expectation that you're always at home, and that's very hard to do. Yeah. So that's why people do give out about constituency work. But there's the reality is, if you don't do your constituency work, you're not going to get elected.
Yeah.
And it was being able to, and I suppose years ago, people would go to the common secretary, say they had a problem, then the secretary would ring me. You know, there was a different way in which things were done. You had a common meeting and issues in the area were raised. Now people do it differently. They email you or they give you a text or a call or WhatsApp or Facebook. There's that much going on
now.
You
can't escape.
Yeah, you can't escape.
Smoke signals if you don't have any technology.
If you're stuck. Yeah. So, you know, that's the difference. That role of the common secretary then kind of eroded when technology nearly took over.
Yeah.
You know? But you always had.
But there was
somebody.
A firewall though, wasn't there? And, and in that first contact, everything didn't have to get elevated, you know what I mean.
No,
so
it didn't.
I think that perhaps is a better. It might feel like you don't have as direct contact, but it's like on our show, we'd get a lot of contact from listeners. Not all of it gets on air, but it's that first contact, and probably the same as way politics used to work.
It is the way to do it, and you know, you instantly something goes wrong, and somebody says, we'll ring Mary Coughlin. So, you know, or we ring Pat the Cope or we ring Denny or, you know, you rang Paddy Hart. You know, people, it was in their minds that was their first port of call for many of them. Or sometimes they would just go to somebody who was kind of your local representative and your county councillors as well or your senator. That was, and that's still going on. The county councillor is still working very closely with their TD.
Yeah. I don't think that's emphasised enough sometimes, you know.
Well,
you know that it's a good pathway up the chain. If
absolutely.
You know what I mean.
That's how you know, TDs rely on county councillors. Yeah. County councillors rely on TDs.
Because I think actually not only would it be good for the TDs, I think it'd actually be good for the councillors that they're seen as a conduit. You
absolutely,
know,
and that's how you get that access.
Now, some of them do it more successfully than others. Whilst down in Dáil Éireann, you met a young man, David Charlton.
That's right. God rest him. A Mayo man. And I have the Mayo flags at the bottom of my lane. I had to take away my Donegal one. Michael Murphy Sr. gave me the flag, so
right.
I had to put it up. I met David in the Dáil. And I was introduced to him by a guard I knew in Ballyshannon, whose father was a independent councillor in Ballyshannon, so that's how I knew him. So I met David in the Dáil, so not too many people meet their future husbands outside Dáil Éireann.
No.
So and then David was in Pier Street, so he then transferred back then to Donegal when we got married. So in Glenties then.
Was it love at first sight, or did he have to grind you down, or what?
No.
Or vice versa?
I think he stood me up the first day because he thought I wouldn't meet him.
That's always a good move, you know. It's always a good move. And obviously you had your children together.
Yeah. We had two, Cahill and Maeve. Cahill's the oldest. I suppose I was a TD at the time. That's where things were different now. I just sit back and I think about myself and Mary Wallace and Bev. We all had our children when we were TDs. Cahill was born the day after the election.
There's a connection to the elections with both of them,
and then
isn't
Maeve
there?
Was born in the middle of the local election. I suppose I went back to work straight away. Like when the local election, 1999, Maeve was born on a Wednesday and I was back tramping the roads on Friday. It wasn't far off the sea. Actually, when Cahill was born, I had to go to Dublin because the Dáil was coming back. So Mary Wallace.
Well, you didn't have to, did you?
Well, you needed the votes.
Yeah.
You had to be there.
Yeah. So it was like
the majority was tight, so it had to be there. Mary Wallace had to do the same. Bev had to do the same. Maura Geoghegan brought her baby to work as well. So it's different now. The Minister for Justice took a year off, and the leader of the Social Democrats took a year off.
But those concessions were hard fought for.
Oh, they were. But like,
and still to this day and age, it seems some level of a.
And I suppose what I had, I was very lucky. First of all, I had my mother, I had my family, and we employed great girls to look after the kids.
But do you have any regrets about that though?
No.
Or because
it's made them independent.
Yeah,
it has made them very independent.
Emotionally independent now.
Yeah, and look at family life was always hugely important. The other thing was they also had their father. He was always there. David was always there. If he wasn't working, he might have been playing golf a wee while, but he was always there. Mm. And that was the decision that we both made.
Yeah. And there's tons of situations whereby you have to make things work.
Loads of people live that way.
Long distance lorry driving.
Yeah.
Whatever it might, you know, there's a million reasons.
People are going away on
yeah.
a Monday morning to work in the UK and come back on a Friday evening or Thursday evening.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not rocket science. It's just that's the reality.
And I don't think it. I don't think it is necessarily to the detriment because you had everything in place.
Yeah.
And there was a sense of physically and emotionally, it's a toll. You know, it doesn't allow you much space.
No, it doesn't.
To recover physically, and you know, having a baby, I'm reliably informed. You know,
you do need a little.
There's
bit
an
of
awful
time.
Lot goes on, yeah. both physically and mentally as well, depending on the individual.
So it was very tiring. I was lucky; it was the summertime, so it wasn't too bad. But I suppose it's a bit like myself. I just got on with it.
And yeah,
had to.
You lost your husband in 2012, and again, you know, as I think you said earlier on, you know, there's lots of families have to go through lots of losses and all that type of stuff. But in some cases, some people have to. It feels like they have to do a little bit more, and that's been the case, I think, in your life with the way things have been, because it doesn't matter how politically astute or tough you are. You know, learning of someone getting a diagnosis and the battle and the fight and the eventual passing, it's very, very difficult. And you've had your fair share of that and more.
Before that, David was in a very bad accident and he lost his leg.
That's right.
And that was very difficult for him personally. But he did very, very well. I've met a number of people who are amputees now. And I think it's important to say that you can have a full life. Mm.
And even now, the technology in terms of the prosthetics.
Much better. Like there's robotics now and everything.
Yeah. But he did the best we thought he could do
he was huge into technology, so he was very, very determined to make sure that he got access to the best that he could get. And it didn't stop him playing golf. It didn't stop him doing his work. He had to change to be into the office. So from many perspects, it didn't really change David's life.
That's obviously down to his character, right?
It was difficult now. There's no point in saying that was easy. It was very difficult for him. And being able to manage the children was a little bit more difficult, but he did it. And then I'd lost my seat and he got sick just shortly after that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was very hard for him. It was just desperate. So it was kind of a turbulent time. You'd lost your seat. Your life was changing. You were wondering what you were going to do. And then David got very sick. But I'm very lucky that I was about.
Yeah.
When you look back in and
isn't
reflect
it's funny
on
it. Situation, actually,
yeah,
isn't it?
That I was there.
Yeah, because there was that time that that you could never get back unless it
exactly.
was...
Exactly, exactly.
And he probably would have been saying, no, you better carry on with that.
Yeah, that would be the kind of him, but That was unfortunate, and it was just unfortunate that time went against him, you know. And that was very hard on the children, because the children were only 14 and 16, you know, fairly difficult time for teenagers.
Mm. Well, you often can feel the world's against you, even when it's not. You don't need evidence of that when you're a teenager.
No, you don't, no. But you just... I also have strong faith, which is something that you have to hold on to as well, and that helps you. So, you know, you use that spirituality, whatever it is that comes to you, whether you're practicing, whatever. You know, you have to have a higher power. You have to have something to look towards and to cling on to. So, you know, that's what I had to use. Plus, I had a complete change of life where I now was at home. And the kids had their own wee routine.
What are you doing,
what am I doing on top of their routine now? So that took a while to get organised.
So that's why you've ended up being so busy, right?
I actually found that more difficult than anything else was that change. And I'd say a lot of TDs who've lost their seats, it goes from manic mental to very quiet. And it is a big change.
Yeah, we'll come back to that, because in the in-between years, you were able, thankfully, to enjoy the support of your husband and the rest of the family. And you needed that because, you know, you were on a political path and an upwards path. You know, it's a big deal to be 21, elected to the Dáil, and a woman. You have to throw that in there too. I don't know. I might ask you a separate question in relation to that. But, you know, could you see yourself, you know, going, right, this is working here. I'm making the right moves. I know the right people. I can maybe get into greater positions of influence and start, you know, really making some differences in the country?
Initially, I would have been hesitant, because I would have been of the view that you need to serve your time.
Yeah.
And in the main, that's usually the right thing to do. Because you have to learn the trade, as
but
one
if
might
you're good
put
enough,
it.
You're old enough,
well,
or experienced enough.
Yeah,
not.
there's a bit of that in it. But for somebody like me, you know, the legislative process had to be dealt with. Being on committees was hugely important. That's where you could have an, like, my very first time to be on a legislative committee was a piece of legislation that I studied in university. First time being changed from 1908. You know, I really enjoyed that part of it.
Yeah, okay, I can imagine.
That was hugely important. But then you were encouraged to do more. My very first speech was in Irish, because the Minister for the Gaeltacht, Dennis Gallagher, said, you represent the Gaeltacht area, that from a respect point of view, you should have your first speech Sreevan na Gaelic. And it was about a new that is in the Gaeltacht, the piece of legislation. So,
were you nervous about that?
I was absolutely petrified. But anyway, I did it. The big great thing about making your first speech, your maiden speech, is you can't be heckled and you can't, nobody can ever go with you.
Yeah.
So, you know, I suppose I was a bit more hesitant in the earlier years. And then once you get, you become more ambitious then. Now, there are people who are overtly ambitious, which I don't particularly like. Whereas my view was you earned your capacity to get there. And you also need a wee bit of luck.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. You do see sometimes maybe people overestimate their ability.
And, you know, you see the turbulence that's going on in the United Kingdom now. There's people who are ministers one day and they're gone nearly 2 weeks or 3 weeks later. So that doesn't help anybody, in my view. But
no, I know you're talking about sort of the accountability, and it's not really, it can be destabilizing at the same time too, can't it?
And then, you know, people say, oh, you were appointed because of geography or because of gender or whatever. Whereas I took a different, totally different perspective. Mary Rourke took the same one, which was, you were there because you were good enough, not because you were somebody or where you came from. And I suppose it took me a while. I built up, I became a chair of a committee, and I moved on then to be an Attaché. And the politics of it is there. You're not going anywhere unless you're in government to start with. I was an opposition spokesperson as well. So that all helped build a reputation and a work ethic. And it helped, in my view.
As a woman, do you have to work harder, or do you feel you have to work harder to counter maybe people thinking that this is a because she's a woman or what have you? It's kind of almost a no-win situation, unless you simply don't care about it.
It can be. Sometimes you have, what is the saying? You have to work twice as much. The attitude of some of the leaders that I had meant that wasn't acceptable. Like Bertie didn't accept it. Cowan didn't accept it.
Well, they were more progressive.
They're more progressive in the view that if you're good enough for the job and you were the right person for the position. And I got encouraged by more senior members of the parliamentary party, the late David Andrews, for example, Joe Walsh, who encouraged you to be more progressive and say just out straight that you would like that opportunity. It doesn't always come to you. Sometimes you have to ask.
Yeah.
And say that you're interested, because your leader will not know you're interested unless you put your hand up. And then I had also been very involved within the party. So in Albert's time was secretary of the party. You know, so I would have been very much involved at a party level as well, which is also in my view, fairly important.
Well, you have to do it's the legwork, isn't it?
It's the legwork and getting to know people.
It's like if you get someone who is an excellent hotel manager, quite often they've worked in the kitchen, they've worked in the bar,
their way up,
they've worked in the bedrooms. They know, because they know what it takes for a business to be successful, mm-hmm. because they've seen. Whereas if someone's appointed into that role, they apply logic that doesn't apply, or whatever it could be.
And hospitality is a very good place to start your life.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
I started at washing dishes in the Abbey when I was about 10. And, you know, it is, and every young person should be afforded the opportunity to work in hospitality. Yeah.
It's
grounding for whatever career you have.
And the summer work in restaurants and pubs, it's great for communication and what have you.
And confidence.
Yeah, for sure. Builds up your confidence. Your most senior up until that point appointment was Minister of State for the Gaeltacht and the Islands, mm-hmm. which was logical geographically. I think it makes sense. I don't think, you know, I think
Denny McGinley was my opposition man. Right, okay. So we got on the best.
You electrified one of the islands in that term, did you?
That's right. And we did a huge amount of work. Now, Eamon O'Queave had started a lot of that work, so I have to give credit to Eamon. He did a huge amount of work. And then I built on that work. And it was the first time there was a real recognition that islanders deserved the same supports as people on the mainland. And there was electrification, there was water, there were roads. You know, a lot of that did help. And, you know, we've done a lot for the islands. Tory has a school, you know, there's the pier at long last had been provided, lovely schools and Elanine and War. So, you know, there was a lot of recognition of the needs of the people. And I suppose Eamon would have been very closely aligned with the islands. And I represented the Gaeltacht as well. So, you know, we had that respect and almost for the people that lived in the Gaeltacht and the islands. And we knew, like, people used to say, why did we start upgrading the road from Killybegs to Glen and Glen? Because Eamon said to me, if we start in Glen, it'll finish in Killybegs eventually. Now, the eventuality is coming. But if we did it the other way around, he says, never be in Glen. So there was a lot of work and a lot of additional support given, top-ups to the Gaeltacht areas, which were badly needed.
Yeah. Oh, so it was from a low starting point. There's no doubt about that. And then Minister for Social and Families Affairs, you were in that post for 2 years.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly important department, right, with very important decisions that are being made, decisions that affect people's lives, livelihood. And people are of the view that, you know, a minister in that position can sign a pen and alleviate the hardship of. And, you know, I presume it's not quite that case, but I'm just wondering, in a position like that, is it tough? Is it tough that you can't fix everything? Or do you have to have a level of immunity or detachment or what? I've always been curious as to what it's like being in a position like that, where the presumption is that you could make changes that would change kids' lives, people's lives, and not make them, inverted commas.
Well, the first
and again,
thing,
that's not a political question.
Well,
as
the
such,
first thing
it's
is
more
you have
a
programme for government.
Yeah.
So those decisions are made prior to the election, and when you're in negotiations, then priorities are, you can't do everything. You have to pick the priorities.
Yeah.
The thing about social welfare, as I would call it, or social protection, is any one decision will have consequences one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So you can put people into a scheme or out of a scheme by just making one decision.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of
so if you broaden
cascading
a scheme,
approach,
it someone else loses
somebody
out.
Somebody loses out.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful about that. In my time, it was every 1 euro was a million, cost a million. So every 1 euro now that's multipliers of that now. And there are new schemes there. Like in my time, we had the Family Support Agency, the family resource centres. There was a huge emphasis on family. We had just done a tour of Ireland looking at the new types of families that there were. And that was the first interaction on blended families and change and all of that. So the family resource centres were very important. And I saw that as a priority, and it's moved now out of that department. There were changes then with supporting carers, for example, supporting disabilities. I remember the Deaf Society coming and making a plea, which very few people had ever done. In other words, that they would get additional support for hearing aids, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. because they became hugely, hugely expensive. We did a lot of work on the dental scheme at the time. Now, it's all changed now. This is what...
It's a long time
ago. Don't be rubbing it in here. So there were those priorities. But then what happened at the time was we ran out of road and we ran out of money.
Yeah. So, right, within the constraints of a budget that's there, and obviously the programme for government has been laid out, so there is mm-hmm. a limit, right, to how far off the path you can go. Either now or in your time, how much control and decision making power does a minister in one of the big in the big jobs have?
The biggest decision maker will be the Minister of Finance.
Yeah.
What happens is there's a process. There's estimates. You'll be given all of the information about what can be changed and what can't be changed. Like if you're in education, you can't say, right, we're taking 50 teachers out of the scheme. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have certain things that you can't change.
Yeah.
In social welfare, so there's certain things you can't change because you have eligibility criteria, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have to decide, have I enough money to put into child benefit? Are we going to put it into the elderly? Are there new schemes? And the big thing about a new scheme is you don't actually know for 100% how much it's going to cost. So you give a guesstimate. Well, it's more than a guesstimate. It's an mathematical analysis.
Yeah.
But it could go up or down depending on
what's happening. And we see now, even now, the finance minister telling departments to rein in the spending.
Yeah.
And they're telling their party colleagues often, listen, you have to pull in the chains.
Exactly. So it takes a lot of negotiating. Social welfare is the last thing that's decided the night before. So, and that's because you'll have your tax package, the minister and the government will have their tax package sorted, and you do that in tandem.
How much consideration is given to the welfare budget in terms of, you know, in an election cycle, for an example?
Huge. No two ways about it. It's very important. And it's also, if you have a programme for government and you haven't achieved everything that you wanted to achieve, you know, usually social welfare is one of the areas that
it can cover a lot.
Now, there are also people in industry who would say to you that we are over generous in social welfare and that it is a turn to getting people back to work. My time, there wasn't as many people working, so getting back to work schemes were very important. Mm. And incentivizing people to get back into work. And all of that was very much the emphasis at the time. My predecessors would have spent a lot of money trying to get people jobs and retraining and getting people with disabilities into the workforce. So, you know, it all depends on what exactly is happening.
Of course, at the moment, we statistically have full employment, really. Yeah. And now that's countrywide. I'm conscious that Donegal, it might not be quite the same. But, you know, you do wonder, it feels inevitable. There is a recession and you see those numbers grow. The bill, even just in welfare, just explodes.
Yeah.
Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and the Food, again, I think a ministry that makes sense with the part of the country that you're from. As I say, I see that as an advantage, to be honest with you. And then the pinnacle, is it, of your political career, deputy leader of Fianna Fáil, Tánaiste. That's a big deal.
Oh, it is a big deal. Look, the Minister for Agriculture was one I thoroughly enjoyed. And I had 4 years of an opportunity there. And that was very much involved at EU as well. And I suppose when I was appointed first, I was the first woman ever to be elected as Minister for Agriculture. A lot of the bigger farmers thought, right, this woman knows nothing about farming. And she comes from the West and all she know about is sheep. It took me a while to ingratiate myself into their thought process.
Did you ingratiate yourself into their thought process, or did you go in there and shoot from the hip and let them know
I learned. Yeah. I learned. First man that came to see me was the CEO of Kerry, a good fanad man. And he came up and he went through what was going on in his area. And, you know, the big dairy people were very cautious about whether I'd know anything about dairy. Forgetting, of course, that just over the road from the studio are some of the best dairy men that there are.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a while, but I also stood my ground and supported the small farmer because their voice was very slight. So when there were schemes, which there were, massive investment in agriculture at the time, I made sure the small farmer was also eligible for these schemes because I thought they had equally as much right to have access. Mm. And, you know, I just see that the bedrock of this part of the world is agriculture.
But do you worry for its future? You know, we're out putting less animals now.
People
I know who are the small farmers, this is their last year or they packed it in a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it's kind of been the death by a thousand cuts. It's the little things along the way to the point where some of the people I know in it now are almost hobbyists. They might as well be keeping bees. Are we going to see a color?
In one way, what's wrong with that? Because it's very good for them. It's good for their mental health.
Oh, it's not a negative thing. Yeah.
It's not necessarily going to be a full-time income for them, but it is something that a lot of them are working. It is something that's in their hearts. It may not be in their pockets. The other thing about farmers is if farmers get a grant or get support, they shop local. They buy local and they support local. So, and every time you open the fridge, some farmer has something to do with whatever's in the
fridge.
But is
it a sunset industry?
No, I don't agree. I don't agree. And I think if anything, what has happened during COVID, what has happened with these wars is just a reality check that, you know, we need to be able to produce our own food. We are massive exporters, as you know, but we cannot lose that skill set.
Mm.
I am sorry to see that there's not as many suckler farmers around here because that was very much the bedrock of around here, sheep. Has taken over. But definitely, I think farming is still hugely important in the food industry. And, you know, there's some unique industries in Donegal. Unique, and they're absolutely fabulous.
Oh, it's amazing, yeah.
Absolutely
amazing. And maybe, you know, and like I've been speaking to farmers too, that instead of maybe going, this isn't for me, they've gone down the artisan route or specialist routes or what have you. And it is evolving. And there's young ones studying it now. And I think you need a degree now really to go into farming. So it'll be interesting to see where it's at. Maybe it's going to be smaller, more consolidated. But
perhaps, but it's still we shall see. And I'll make a wee bit. I also now am involved in forestry. So it's also something that farmers can very much have as part of their enterprise, in my view.
So back to you being
the Taoiseach
then. I mean, it's a huge role for you.
Mm-hmm.
You're the deputy leader of the party that your whole family have worked so
of
your whole family has worked so.
Look, there's a lot of hype about it because of the fact.
Don't be matter of fact now.
It's kind of I'm just thinking back now, looking out the window, thinking it's a bit like last year. This time last year, we all thought we were going to win in All-Ireland.
Yeah.
But it was a huge honour. And the honour wasn't just on me or my family, but a lot of the people in Donegal who worked towards that political genre that was there. And I suppose there was a huge expectation that because you were the deputy leader, that things would immeasurably transformed.
Yeah, but it was a really brilliant job at a really bad time.
A very bad time. But sure, look, it still was there. It was. Mm.
But you were hamstrung to some extent.
Because financially, there was going to be a huge mountain to climb. But it still didn't take from the fact that it was a huge honour to have that opportunity, tough and all as it was.
Mm.
And it was tough on everybody who was elected. And it was tough on everybody that was in cabinet.
Did we have much foreknowledge of what was to come in terms of that crash, or was it genuinely sort of an international? I mean, obviously, listen, I think as elected reps, but even us as a population, I was living beyond my means. I had two credit cards, loans. I thought, you know, you thought, wow.
You'll get it paid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Now I'm still paying for a 200-year-old lawnmower that I had to get the credit card into the mortgage, right? But did it come as a shock to the political world, the significance of the crash?
I think if you look back in the 80s, we had massive unemployment. Mm. People had nothing.
And most 15% people, interest rate, yeah, 16, 17.
Yeah, it was huge. And people were struggling and a lot of people left. We put a huge emphasis into skills and education, which has paid off and will continue, I hope, to pay off. And then all of a sudden, we got access to money. And we thought, right, we deserve it, which we do. There's nothing to say that we haven't worked hard enough to have a standard of living that we would like to have or would like to achieve. And you studied hard for or whatever. But I think the excesses, the availability of loans, the capacity to pay things back. And it wasn't, there was the big boys who went over the top, but I suppose it happened in a lot of houses.
But I think almost like individually, as families, as a county and as a country, from the ground to the top, we all got lost the run of ourselves.
Well,
many of us did.
Our predecessors, every penny was a prisoner.
Mm.
And you didn't buy anything unless you had it. You never got a loan or anything like that. And we've moved from that to, you know, but then there were people in the regulatory positions who allowed that to happen. That was the other thing.
Mm.
Mm. And then the crash in the United States, and it was the same thing happened in the United States. It was the housing market. It was the loosening of regulations that allowed things to happen. And then these bad debts started to move.
Yeah, four or five times more. I mean, like I recall just before, not long before, I'm terrible at timelines, but, you know, like in excess of 100% mortgages and stuff, like, or 100%, but you could see where it was coming. Like, it was just, this is the last, let's see what we could drag the last bit out of this
and
economy.
And
then bang.
Onto it and things like that.
Oh,
and
stuff.
Look, it hit people very hard, and good, honest, hardworking people lost the capacity then to repay, which was, this was the torment that that people went through.
And we could do an entire show in relation to the crash and the around that. I was going to ask you, we touched on you being deselected, losing your seat, and because it's so interwoven with the loss of your husband, do you separate? You can't really separate them out, can you? I mean, it was...
Well, I suppose we had a by-election just beforehand, and we had a very young senator who had put his name forward. And I was thinking, right, here's a young fella who's just started, and we're not now going to have Mary Coughlan not having him on the ticket.
Mm.
I suppose if you looked at it, maybe it would have been if you had only one person running. You might have won. But Brian was as entitled as anybody else. We always ran two, and it just didn't work out. I knew in my own electoral area, I think it was 10:45, I knew I was gone because the locality didn't vote for you.
Mm.
And I suppose strategically that was an issue. But I, like a lot of my other colleagues, decided they wouldn't go forward, whereas I said, look at, I'm going to go down. I might go up in flames, but I was going to go back.
People are going to make that decision for various reasons. Mm. I presume some of them, I ain't going to get a kicking. I'm going to go out on my own
terms.
And then
some of them are older than me anyway,
of course.
So they were going to retire.
Be different reasons.
Yeah,
but,
I said I was going to put my name forward and still. And I had the support of my own electoral base in that my own organisation supported me. But just look at the votes weren't there and it didn't happen.
Yeah, and sometimes strategies work and, and sometimes they don't. So post that, obviously we mentioned the loss of David, and you've got teenage children there that you have time for. How long did you take out, if you know what I mean?
I started then at home. I was asked to be secretary of St. Noel's, which is also a full time job. So any secretaries that are listening now have a full time job being secretary of their club. And I suppose that was because Cahill played football, and I wanted to give back to the people that gave support to me as well. And I enjoyed it. I liked the GAA anyway. Then, you know, people thought I had nothing better to do. So you got roped into boards of management. And
but you weren't saying no.
No, I did say no because, like, why not do it? No point sitting up in front. But
you obviously didn't
window,
feel
it's, you know,
a fall of grace, fall from grace. I mean, you obviously weren't so tied up in yourself that thought these types of roles would have been beneath you. I mean, you literally have just been, you know, the deputy leader of the country.
But that was, I suppose, that's the
and
way.
And St. Noel's is a great club. Don't get me wrong, but the scales.
Ivan
here,
is
right?
Not an average.
No, it's not.
But
Division
look at,
Two.
Now, don't you start. We're going to square up to you boys in Convoy now on Saturday.
We'll see.
But I never, Don Breslin had a saying, never ask a man to do something you wouldn't do yourself.
Yeah. Which works in hospitality
and
too.
Works in every way of life. Yeah. So there was nothing to say. I couldn't make sandwiches in Frosser's Hall or, you know, help with the flowers or, like, that's just the way I am, you know. Mm. I enjoy it and I'm part of the community. And I think everybody should help their own community, no matter where they come from. I suppose somebody said to me one time, normally your progression into political life is you start with maybe the football club or the Tidy Towns or the Hall Committee, and then you move into the local.
Right?
I did it the other way around. Yeah. So the chat in Frosses was you had to be a tarnisher now to be able to be on the committee.
Not sure. They might struggle for replacements.
They might
there,
struggle for
But it is interesting. And there's an old saying that, you know, be nice to the people on the way up because you might have to meet them on the way down.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in any way as on the way down. But you obviously kept people on side and would have been decent to people because you had to, you know.
That's the way I
the community
feel.
Has to back you too, I presume. You know, your people were very proud of you too.
Oh, absolutely.
I was very
proud of representing Donegal people. And then I suppose once the Leaving Cert and all that jazz, people panicking now coming up to August, I suppose. I was asked to do a bit of work for a business person in the UK. To look after his portfolio, and I did. And out of that, I was asked to do more work for different other people in different organisations. And then I was on the board of Local Link, and then I became the chair of the national group. So it kind of evolved after I decided I was going to go back into and set up a little company of my own. And it grew from there and developed from there. So it was out. Really through connections of people that asked me would I do a particular job, and I work with certain people now and I represent their portfolios.
Are you
and I do
better off than when you were in politics? I'm trying. I'm not asking for any figures.
I'm not a multimillionaire now.
I'm not asking for any figures, but you know, sometimes the private sector can
Oh, the private sector can be much better, but no, I just do enough to keep me interested. Interested.
So does that mean you're good
at
knowing your limits then, right? So you know your capacity and to work within that. Is that something you're good at, you've learned, or maybe you're stretched to the limit?
I stretch myself to the limits. I stretch myself to
the limits. Some people that work best in that situation.
Yeah.
Obviously, an important role in women in farming chairperson. That was a scoop for them, obviously, because of your obviously your profile, but also your background in with responsibility in the same sort of a space. Mm-hmm. But it's also empowering, uplifting, and giving a voice to women too, which I'm sure you're very proud of.
Absolutely, a lot of changes taking place, as you know, in agriculture, and there's quite a lot of women who would like to be represented better. They would like to own their own herds. They like to have their own herd number. I think things have changed. Attitudes have changed, not altogether, but I think the younger farmer is more accepting.
But it's succession work, and
succession
has to work in that area too.
Is always difficult, and you can see how land is still, you know, difficult for a lot of families and can cause all sorts of issues. But no more than the artisan, I would say the majority of artisan people are actually women, and have been very, very good and have developed very well. there are certain things that need to be done and have been done, like TAMS has now been made available more to women. It's just given that little bit of additionality.
And I did an interview with some of the women, powerful women, being really proactive themselves and having open days on their farms and their milk factories and bringing people together and getting that network as well. I think that's critical because you need to help each other.
You need that support,
And you, I mean, and obviously what a lot of people would know you as now, and actually, you know, for a generation, it's probably they think it's the only thing you ever did. And that's becoming the first female chair of the Donegal GAA County Board. How did that appointment come about?
It was an election anyway to start with, but
sorry. I forget who I'm talking about when I talk about appointments.
You're right.
Go on.
Well, anyway, it was the Ingu, but anyway. I had been secretary of Naoimh na Aille for many, many years. And then, as you know, Donegal GAA went through a fairly turbulent time with the academy and a few other matters. And some of the clubs were on the lookout for a new chair.
Yeah.
There were three people nominated. Getting to make the decision that you would do it was, I suppose, the hardest part, but I got a lot of encouragement to do it. And I said, right, I'll do this and see how it works out. Everybody belonged to me, thought I was mental.
I was actually going to ask you, what would your mother have said?
Oh, she just thought I was completely mad altogether. But I seem to be, that's the trajectory.
You attract yourself to it,
I seem to attract that. Yeah. So that's how it happened. Yeah. And I enjoy it. It's tough. Like, it is tough, but I have a good team, and the team are the people, the volunteers.
Did you, I mean, obviously you're still in that position now, and it feels like we're in a good place. Was there much cleaning up to do?
There was a reorientation, I think would be the word one would use. And there were certain governance issues that had to be dealt with. And
but this legacy stuff, just
some of
stuff
it's legacy stuff. And I suppose that the bottom line is these are all volunteers, you know, and then there's this imposition of all sorts of things that come from Croke Park, you know, rules, regulations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like some people just don't have time to do these things.
Yeah.
They just physically can't do anymore.
Was there a cultural shift that had to happen?
There was a big one. And
can you talk a bit about it?
Well, I suppose the thing is that you're dealing with people's personality. You're dealing with personalities.
And people are coming from
different perspectives, and people have different ambitions. And I suppose the team wasn't doing well either, and that didn't help. And then you had this new momentum where Jim came back and our sponsors stayed with us, and people had hope and they wanted things to do well and they wanted things to happen. And I suppose they wanted a bit of new leadership, I suppose would be the way of putting it, and a new team. And that team was elected. And as you know, a lot more women now on our county board, on our executive. Not as many women as we would like to see representing their clubs at county committee, but
maybe that's a trickle down thing rather than a trickle up.
Yeah, so I'd like to see that'd be more women represented at county committee. And I suppose there was a lot of work done by my predecessor in starting that process. And we had people brought in from Croke Park to allow that process to develop. And they were given protocols which are working and that we deal with now. And I suppose, we just pulled it all back and started back all up again. Mm. And I think the fact that the team started to do well lifted people.
Yeah, it's very easy to forget when we get disappointed at losing an All Ireland final or losing.
We were Division 3.
It was dire
Division
at the time.
Division 2, Division 1, you know, McKenna Cup. We won Ulster twice. We've gone from a quarter final, a semi final to a final. Like, there's a lot of people give their right arm for that.
Oh, 100%. We go from being, you'd be glad to be drawn against Donegal to being a nightmare.
And then, of course, the big emphasis has to be on our young people and on the academy, on the development squads and on our clubs. And
Because the decision made now, well, or the planning put in now, we don't see that for...
And I suppose that's what happened. The momentum from 92 kind of waned, 2012. So you would hope the aspiration now is that that momentum would continue and that it wouldn't be the stop-start. It's not that you'd win an All-Ireland every year. It's not that the Miners wouldn't win an All-Ireland every year, but that stop-start would be a continuum now. And I suppose an acceptance that we can win.
Yeah, of course. Are we, like, I used to have a perception that there was a bit of a, no problem, there's a bit of a sort of a north and south campy type of way in Donegal GEA.
there used to be.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is that factual?
That was population based.
Of course. But there was this notional split that we see in the newspapers. You know, you remember the Democrat, North and South.
Yeah.
Northwest Radio, Highland Radio, this thing that was the constituencies, obviously, is the most obvious example. And there did feel to be sort of a, right, the South has control of it now. No one's going to get picked from Bunkrana or...
the South... was, I suppose, had more GAA in it. Any shown were very soccer orientated.
A bit of hurling in there too, yeah.
Completely changed.
Yeah.
Populations in Any Shown. The clubs have put huge amount of work up in Any Shown. And the population has gone down in the South. So the Gaeltacht area is now a population has, you know, like we've had a number of schools that have closed.
Yeah.
So, you know, that change is there. There's nothing to say that. And the clubs have become stronger in Any Shown in places like that. And I would like to see and ensure that we do have that geographical spread.
But then we've got four masters doing fantastic and a young team coming through and you can pick it out here and there.
But people have to make themselves available.
Yeah, well, that's
the other thing.
But my point is we recognise that perhaps maybe in the past it wasn't as united a countywide organisation.
No, probably not. And now you'd mentioned hurling. Like hurling is something that now that the academy is relatively well set up, that the development squads are doing fairly well, we're looking at new ways of developing, coaching, supporting. You know, we have a couple of phases now within the context of supporting our coaches, supporting our clubs, being more inclusive. Having more people with disabilities who are able to engage with the GAA, and we've had some cool camps which have been fantastic, and also developing hurling. And you know, I'm delighted. Like our under 15s won an All Ireland.
Yeah, it's astonishing.
And our senior team has done so well. And it's a lovely game. It's a fantastic game. And it's part of who we are.
And the women's game's in good shape too.
The women are doing well.
We went through a period of rebuilding there.
Yeah, we're working well with the LGFA to the best of our ability.
Yeah.
Terribly disappointed about our under 20s, but look at. They got as far as.
Would
the
you
final.
Like to see as soon as possible the ladies' game and the men's game coming under the one roof?
Integration's a big thing that's out there.
Yeah.
I think there's fairly practical things can be done.
Yeah.
But you know, trying to mould people over a very short period of time is not going to work.
Yeah, I get you. That makes
it's
sense.
It's just not going to work.
As long as the planning is happening and
we need more facilities like. We have Convoy there. Now, we're very lucky. Convoy is there. It's fantastic. We have five pitches. We could do it with five more pitches.
Mm.
We're now involved in a fundraising draw for more indoor facilities, training facilities. Because we do have the ladies, we have the hurlers, we have the footballers, we have the camogues. You know, they're all, you know, need facilities.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe that climate change has a massive impact on our games. Because of all the rain.
Yeah.
Like we've had so many clubs that have not been able to field in their own clubs because everything's waterlogged.
Yeah.
And then Per Convoy then is under massive pressure. So, you know, we talk about climate change and people might tut-tut-tut. There's a fair reality about what's going on.
I speak to farmers and they talk about how, you know, you can't fish now anymore and you used to and, you know, the spuds are coming out later in the year, and then they'll say, well, climate change isn't a thing. Yeah, they describe exactly the...
what climate change is, yeah.
And finally, and it's been fantastic having you on the podcast. I would imagine what's happening is groundwork, right? So that the Donegal GAA has been putting a footing.
Yes.
Right. So that, in other words, we don't have peaks and troughs.
Exactly.
And that's we've come important. From a trough, but this is not a case whereby we end up back there again. That the framework, the foundations, and all that are in there. I don't know if you met with Jim McGuinness yet, or like is do you think he's going to lead Donegal into the future? I'm going to cut this out of the podcast. This is for Oisin. No, I don't know. I'm only joking.
Jim, he's a fantastic manager, and he has really, really lifted not just his team, but he's lifted the county.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a burden, I would say, on Jim himself personally as well. But it's very important that we ensure that we have great managers and great coaches in our own county. That's really, really important. And that's why the work that Carl and Sean are doing in the academy.
Did you just dodge a question?
No.
I'm only joking. Go ahead.
That Carl and Sean will do is to ensure that we have a Jim McGuinness.
So there's conveyor belts in management as well as on the pitch.
You really, really have to.
We have a bit of action in Westmeath going on as well, too.
Well, that's it. Like, you know, and it's not to say that whoever we have here as coaches can't cut their teeth somewhere else. You know, it's great to see it, but we need to grow our own people as well. And that's the clubs have to do the same. Mm. We have to try and grow our own people.
And we can't keep going back to the Jim McGuinness well. Eventually he'll want to do something else.
Oh, absolutely.
Well,
and like, he's been very supportive to a lot of people. Mm. So, you know, we can't just expect one man to be carrying the whole. You can't expect Michael Murphy to carry everything either. You know, we have great talent. We have good footballers. We have great hurlers. But they need to be encouraged and coached. And they may need to be given the capacity to do that.
So we've kind of gone through, a few players, probably, you know, for Jim, one last go with it, and not predetermining what any senior players decide or what the management decide. But do you think we're at a crossroads as to where, you know, which a new era, a continuation of the last era for one last rattle at it? Or what do you think? What would you like?
Well, of course, everybody would like to win an All-Ireland.
Yeah. whatever the best way to do that is.
Yeah, exactly. But look at being successful on the field is very important. But the thing is, you also have to enjoy it. You have to enjoy playing football. You have to enjoy playing Ireland. And like, we have fabulous people there, and they deserve the greatest opportunities that should be given to them. And look at, the game has changed immeasurably. You've just seen fantastic people not just making the next grade. You know, nobody would have said Mayo would have been in an Ireland final. Nobody. They would have said maybe Louth, Donegal, definitely. You know,
they've
nobody
come up the inside track.
Exactly. Nobody would have said Dublin would have gotten to a semi final with all the turbulence and all the hassle that they had to go through and the difficult campaign they had.
But football's in a fantastic position.
It is.
For all of the reasons you've just outlined, and then throw us in the mix as well. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, listen, as you say, we don't want this up and down and up and down, and there's certainly a lot of.
You have to have a bedrock and you have to be able to continue.
And that's often behind the scenes.
Exactly. Yeah. And then financially, it takes a lot of money to do it. Mm. And that's also something that's.
How are our finances?
Everybody's struggling. Yeah. Everybody is struggling. Every club's struggling, every county's struggling. And I know they've been talking about amateur status and trying to curtail the costs. But then people want to ensure that everybody is afforded the same opportunities. So, you know, there's reality check there.
It goes right back to the politics whereby if you make a decision, something gives down the line.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, listen, it's been lovely having you on the podcast. Thank you so very much indeed. We really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much yourself.